This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. Coming up in the show, I'm very pleased to welcome back to Life Elsewhere acclaimed author Nicholson Baker, who has a new must-read book, Baseless: My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. Now, this is a deeply troubling book as Nicholson explores and unravels the secrets of biological and germ warfare. It's also a diary of the author's life as he searches for answers hidden away in classified archives. First, my guest is Colin Dickey. He has a brand new book. It's called The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Colin, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, I'm going to start off by telling you I really enjoyed your book. I love the way it's written. You've got a very interesting style, the way you've written. And I want to share something with you, Colin. Many years ago, I was on a road trip from Seattle, where I was living at the time, and I was going down to Los Angeles, and we stopped overnight in the little town of Shasta.
Oh, great, yeah.
And the next morning, we went for breakfast at a diner. We ordered our food and it arrived, and I decided to add some ketchup to my plate of eggs and bacon. And I grabbed the ketchup bottle and I gave it a vigorous shake. And unfortunately, the last person that had used the ketchup hadn't screwed the top on properly. So the ketchup went all over the place. Behind me sat this huge man with a big grizzly beard and a plaid shirt and suspenders. And he looked like a lumberjack, and it went all over his shirt. So I tried to quickly dab it off, and he turned around and he realized we were foreigners, we were tourists, and he was very nice about it, and he was very polite, and he said, I guess you're here, you're looking for him, aren't you, you're searching for him. And I was like, what? And of course, you know the rest. I mean, then he told us a great long story, and he was very proud of that. In fact, he lived in Shasta. I think he was a retired logger, a retired lumberjack. I thought I'd share that with you because it sort of made me think about when I was reading your book about that story. Let's just quickly start off by talking about that very strange place of the Lemurians. Is that how you pronounce the name? I've always been curious about that.
Yeah, that sounds fine to me. Yeah, I mean, so Mount Shasta has developed this rather bizarre reputation as the home to the secret lost city of Telos, which is the last remnant of the lost continent of Lemuria, which is something I sort of came across in my, research, and I found evidence that some people in the 1920s and 30s had really camped out in Mount Shasta. And I thought, well, you know, too bad that's over. And then I did a little bit more poking around. I thought, good Lord, this is still going on. And I went up there, and sure enough, I found a bunch of people with all sorts of crazy stories. So in short, yeah, there's a theory that, you know, just as Atlantis is a sunken continent in the Atlantic Ocean, Lemuria is the sunken continent in the Pacific Ocean, you know, contained this vast civilization that we've lost. But somehow some people have argued that in fact, it persists in the state of California. And in fact, it could be the case that, you know, California is the former remnant of Lemuria that got sandwiched into North America in some crazy fashion or whatever. And that you can find all this in Mount Shasta. And so they get described in different ways. They get described as a sort of vastly superior alien race. They also get described in sort of terms that sound an awful lot like Bigfoot, sort of large, hairy creatures of some kind. You know, I spent a couple of days up there, and I, you know, people told me that there was, you know, secret government labs on the mountain, that there was, you know, flying saucers that would come out and, you know, fly around. And, you know, people told me all sorts of very weird stories. The more I talked to everybody, everybody seemed to know something about the mountain. And it is a really kind of interesting lens into the way in which a seemingly innocuous place, although, you know, it is quite a beautiful mountain, but a seemingly innocuous place can have these layers of sort of really fascinating and bizarre kind of mythological or supernatural meaning attached to them.
Yeah, this is what's so fascinating about your book, is that sometimes some of the places that you visited and you talk about are kind of, just you say, innocuous. I mean, they're just, yet at the same time, having been to Shasta and having lived in the Pacific Northwest, where Bigfoot roams, according to some legends, there are these places where it does feel, when you start to think about it, a little eerie. Is this how these legends or these myths or these stories arise? I'm always curious, and your books explain some of it, but a lot of it seems to be that people just love legends. They love these mystical things, don't they?
Right. Oh, certainly. I think it's a really innate feature of kind of human, you know, I guess identity to kind of, you know, seek after, you know, the unexplained and the you know, unexplainable. And, you know, some of us do that by, you know, going into scientific fields or at least sort of taking an interest in science and, you know, exploring things that way. Some people maybe explore that phenomenon through religion or whatever. And then there's this other group of people that sort of looks for these kind of, you know, like the cryptids, which is, you know, catch-all phrase for, you know, Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and all that stuff, or aliens, you know, who are maybe hiding in Area 51 in the Nevada desert. And I think when I try to sort of, you know, gather all these things up together, what kept coming back to me is that these places seem to be all right on the edge of civilization. So yeah, so you mentioned the Redwood Forests of California, which are kind of, you know, they're near the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, but they're you know, outside, or, you know, Area 51 is, you know, about an hour or so from Las Vegas. So it's, you know, it's close, but it's, you know, just, it's hidden just beyond those mountains over there, you know?
Yes.
And I think we have a desire to believe that, you know, just on the edge of civilization, just on the edge of the known world, there's this frontier, and beyond the frontier, there's something kind of wild and mysterious and unexplainable. And, you know, with this book, I try to kind of follow some of those paths and see what happens when you went just outside of the known world.
Yes. Colin Dickey is my guest. His book is called The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexpected. When I was talking about my visit to Shasta, you talked about lost cities, and I think you kind of touched on Atlantis. So we've got to talk about Ignatius Donnelly.
Yeah, right. And so Ignatius Donnelly, he's a kind of failed entrepreneur. Then he goes into Congress in the 1860s, and he serves a couple of terms in the House of Representatives. And you know, political forces, you know, kind of shift, and he ends up looking for a third act. And in the 1870s, what he does is he writes this book on Atlantis, where he takes this idea from Plato, you know, who's the first person to write about Atlantis, the Greek philosopher. And in Plato's world, it's just sort of it's like a thought experiment. It's like a utopia that he's sort of using to kind of get across his philosophical ideas. Donnelly takes this and argues that it's a literal place. And he's the first person to write this book where he basically argues that it is real, you know, and it can be sort of found through archaeological and anthropological traces. And again, I mean, this is a period when, you know, the Western frontier in the United States has pretty much, you know, vanished. You know, the Native American genocide has pushed the original inhabitants of this land into, you know, reservations and sort of driven them off their land. And that kind of settler kind of, you know, mentality has run its course. And so there's no more, you know, quote unquote frontier left in the United States. And so Donnelly then turns around and he sort of conjures up this mythical place that is, again, it's sort of perpetually just on the other side of the frontier. We're never going to get there. There's never going to be a railway that goes to Atlantis. There's never going to be a Starbucks in Atlantis. So it can always be this place that is fantastical and magical and unreachable.
Do you think there's something which comes across in your book, and that is that we're living in a time where it's almost like we need to escape from reality, and that's why there's such an interest in mythical monsters and alien encounters? Is that your conclusion?
I think so. I mean, I think that as the world starts to feel like it's getting smaller, you know, first through, you know, the invention of the railway system, and then, you know, eventually down to our age with, you know, the internet, the world starts to feel smaller and more connected and more streamlined. And there kind of arises out of a maybe reaction to that, this kind of idea of a, you know, resistance to that, which takes the form of someplace that's kind of, you know, unreachable or an animal that is, you know, uncapturable on film, you know, the cryptid. I mean, the word cryptid just means hidden, you know, hidden.
Yes.
Animal, like cryptography. So, you know, it's something that is, we get this yearning for something that's never going to show up on social media, that's never going to be, you know, fully documented or fully explained, but we can always kind of dream about.
Before you go, I've got to ask you about something which I was just fascinated by. That's, of course, the Great Kentucky Meat Shower. Let me hear from you about that, Colin.
Yeah, so the Great Kentucky Meat Shower is an event from 1876, which, yes, I mean, I couldn't stop thinking about this when I first learned about it. It's, on a cloudless day in Olympia Springs, Kentucky, there, a woman and her grandson are outside and meat falls from the sky, chunks of meat, inexplicably. And it's not a hoax. It's not a fantasy. The townspeople gather up this meat. A couple of them even bravely try and eat it to see if they can identify it by taste. That doesn't really go well. But you know, it is this literal phenomenon. And at first, scientific journals kind of bat around different possibilities. You know, what could have caused it? What is this stuff? You know, they do some scientific tests, but they can't really ever come to anything conclusive. And ultimately, it just gets kind of lost by the wayside. And so, you know, I wanted it kind of in this book because I wanted to rescue this idea that there are always going to be stuff. There's always going to be events and things out there that just don't quite fit. And that doesn't, you don't necessarily have to jump to conspiracy theories. You don't necessarily have to adopt an anti-scientific point of view in order to accommodate those. You just you can just sort of have them there, yeah, sort of as these weird, unexplainable things, and just kind of wow and just marvel at them. And so, you know, I end up in the book, I ended up trying to track down the last surviving chunk of the Great Kentucky Meat Shower in a place called the Monroe Musnick Museum in Transylvania University. But yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting story because it's a reminder that, you know, there's still a lot we don't know, and that's fine. And that's cool. That's amazing.
Yes. Before you go, quick question about what you describe as cranks. Just want to hear it from you about cranks, because I'm fascinated by this.
Right. And so, okay. So we talked a little bit about Ignatius Donnelly. Donnelly is a sort of textbook crank. He's somebody who comes along with a theory of how the world works. And it's vaguely scientific, but it actually doesn't hold up to any kind of scrutiny at all. And it doesn't really work. By contrast, there's this guy, Charles Fort, which is where I first learned about the Kentucky Meat Shower from. So Fort, he's a writer a little bit later than Donnelly in the 19 teens. And at first he starts writing, you know, crank books. He tries to write this book about how all human behavior is controlled by radio waves from the planet Venus. And it doesn't get published. He destroys the manuscript where we don't have it. But he then writes this book called The Book of the Damned, which is his sort of masterpiece. And he refers to these things as damned facts that don't fit our scientific understanding. And unlike a crank, he doesn't try and offer a theory for them. He just kind of gathers them all up, you know, the Kentucky meat shower and ball lightning and, frog rains and fish that turn to blood. And he just kind of puts them all on the page and says, look, these things are damned because nobody wants to deal with them, but they're in the historical record. They happened, and it's our duty to at least acknowledge they exist, even if we don't have a good explanation for why they happened.
In doing the putting the book together, was there one thing that just caught your attention? Was there something that just made you go, oh my goodness, I hadn't thought of that?
Beside the Kentucky meat shower?
Meat shower, yes.
I think there's a story about the abduction or the failed abduction of a woman's son from Lawndale, Illinois by this strange bird that nobody can really understand where this bird came from. And I think it's like it's a weird thing. And I hadn't really thought much about it, but it again, it's one of those things I don't have a good answer for. Cryptozoologists love it. I can't quite go there, but I also can't quite dismiss it. And so, that's a thing that really sticks with me that I've thought a lot about in sort of working through this book, I guess.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. And it seems to me like you had a lot of fun writing it and doing your adventures.
Yeah, it was definitely fun. It was definitely fun to go to Shasta and sort of all around the world kind of looking for these kind of weird stories. And I had a blast writing that. I hope it comes through in the book as well.
Yeah, it certainly does. A good job. The book is called The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. My guest has been Colin Dickey. Thank you, Colin, very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much for having me on. This is a lot of fun.
Details about the books featured at Life Elsewhere can be found at lifeelsewhere.co. You can also find all the listings of stations that air Life Elsewhere. The podcasts are available at NPR1, Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, Mixcloud, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Next, my conversation about fleas and mosquitoes and feathers used as weapons, plus a peep into the daily life diary of highly regarded author Nicholson Baker when we talk about his new book, Baseless.
This is Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. Let us know what you think of our show. Send your comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
The title of the book is Baseless, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. So my guest is an author and a writer that I've just loved having on the program. He is a major author. He's somebody that I just love talking to. And today we're doing it by Zoom, which is fantastic, so we can see one another. Nicholson Baker is with me. Nicholson, welcome back to Life Elsewhere.
I'm so glad to be back on your show, and I always like talking to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Nicholson. I just showed you on Zoom here, and we will put this up. We're going to do the audio part, but the video part will go up. But as you can see, I've been making a lot of notes about your book. In fact, it's almost to the point where I've made a note on almost every single page because there's so many quotable things that you say. So there's a couple of things I want to get into. First of all, it's a wonderful book. That's the first part.
Thank you very much.
The takeaway for me here is that I'm like my eyebrows went up. I'm just like my like deer in the headlights because this is a shocking story. At the same time, this is a remarkable story of you and your life because it's also a diary. And that's what I loved about this book is that I felt like I knew your home. I know your dogs, I know the walks that you take and the weather in Maine. I mean, I just got the feeling that I was living Nicholson Baker's life. So there's two really important things for me. So let's now start talking about the book. And I want to start by asking you about one word that's in the subtitle to your book, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. Nicholson, why ruins?
It's not as if the ruins might be repairable. I guess what happened was there was a great law on the books. It's still on the books. It took a long time to get passed. And when it became effective in the mid-60s, it was quite a powerful law. Gradually, over decades, it has sustained a number of concussions and attacks and reductions of power and crankings down. And so now it is the law that is a broken law. It's a law that doesn't actually ever get enforced. And the only way that you can use this law effectively as a citizen, which you're supposed to be able to ask for anything you want, is to bring suit. If you bring suit, then and use the legal system in its most, direct form, sue an agency for documents, you will probably get something. You may get something. It may take you 5 years. There may be appeals and overturnings, but it'll happen. But that's why it's a series of ruins, of spectacular, noble ruins, I think.
Yes. So let's get further into it. You wanted to find out, and let's be kind of generalize here, did America use bio warfare in Korea? And this led you on this great, I guess, chase, hunt, investigation. We could call it all kinds of things. And you document it day by day in your diary. Talk to me about the beginnings of it, about for you, Nicholson Baker, starting this book off, Baseless.
The research started a long time ago. So I've been looking at some of this stuff for more than 10 years. But the idea of doing it as a day-by-day diary is much more recent. And I think that it allowed me to write the book because it allowed me to be tentative and to be and to show my own frustrations with the things that I didn't know, and also to make comparisons that are unchronological. You know, if you're writing a normal work of history, you have to go, well, this began, and then there was this thread that happened, and this, and you go more or less in chronological order. This one, it's not like that. I get up in the morning, feed the dogs, take the dogs out in the snow, think about the snow, make coffee for my wife, bring some coffee into my wife, all the stuff that people do, you know, just my little tiny life. But in the midst of this little tiny life that I'm leading, I'm talking about things that are, you know, seismic and disturbing and dark and really weird, you know? So it was, I think that conjunction interested me.
Yes. So let me give you an idea of how this affected me. So I'm on page 5. And this is where it started to make me go, oh my goodness, what am I in for here? Because you write, bombs packed with fleas and mosquitoes and disease-dusted feathers. What was your reaction? I mean, you probably knew a little bit beforehand, but did you know about that, about feathers and insects and mosquitoes?
I first learned about it because I was working on a book about libraries and microfilm, and I was learning about the Cold War in a general way because microfilming programs were associated with Cold War efforts to shrink information. And so I found a book, a particular book written by two Canadian scientists, wrote a kind of institutional history of America's biological warfare research program, which fascinated me partly because my own grandfather was a pathologist, and one of the diseases on their list of weaponizable diseases that the U.S. government had looked into was this thing that I knew from his own dinner table conversation. My grandfather was shameless, and he would just talk about coccidioidomycosis, you know, while we were having turkey dinner. I mean, on Thanksgiving Day, we're talking about fungal diseases. It just it used to really trouble my grandmother, and she got him finally to stop talking about postmortem examinations and very bizarre diseases and start talking about world peace. And then he just talked about world peace relentlessly. But so that was that. Reading this book pulled me into a world that I didn't know existed. And so I then decided I wanted to get to know these two guys. This was about 10 years ago. Yeah. And I interviewed them and gradually learned more. And there's a lot you can learn that's already been written about the subject. But the juicy places are still missing. The pieces of the story that we need are still not there.
And then there's a part that you say in the early part of the book, and I'm just paraphrasing right now, that you know that when you try to get some of the secretive information documents, that some of the pieces are going to be redacted or blanked out.
Right.
And you say, and I think I've got it here, it says, I wonder if I'd be able to read the document without blacked out lines before I die.
I sometimes felt, because it, you know, I filed a lot of requests in 2012 asking for a number of documents, not that many, 21 documents, but it's now 2020 and I've had no response. And realizing that, you know, I'm a mortal person, and it's as if the Air Force, the United States Air Force, is waiting for me to die. Much prefer me to, or at least to go senile or something. It would prefer that I abandon this particular line of research and go on to writing about, you know, memoirs of walking along the Penobscot River or something. And that is what happens very often. I mean, part of the strategy of delay on the part of big secretive agencies is just go so slowly that people get on with their lives and they put that particular area of research away. And that works very, very well. But I decided that I wasn't going to tolerate it, and that I was going to write about that particular form of what is almost psychological warfare against historians. You know, why are they doing this to us? Is sometimes what crossed my mind.
One thing that comes across for me in your search and trying to get the information is I didn't get the feeling that it was, in some respects, it was a concerted effort of all the different organizations or military involved. It seemed to me that it was just part of the system. Am I right in that?
I think you are right. What the daily life of a person who works in the industry that is involved in the keeping of secrets. He might be a federal contractor, or he might work in the Pentagon or the CIA or something, is that he looks at documents that have been requested and makes a decision about whether to release the document at all or not. And then if you release the document, what pieces of it should be redacted or blanked out or whited out? Redaction is a wonderful, infuriating euphemism, yeah, because we're just talking about keeping stuff from the people who paid for it. So his job is to make those decisions. And the interesting thing is, a given redactor, a given information declassifier will make very different decisions on different days. He or she is a person of moods and differences of outlook. And then those decisions are not consistent, but there are one thing that there's sort of a guide that the person has, and it's a list of sort of super dark, super careful, sensitive words. It's usually a word list, and it's words like biological warfare or BW, China, Korea, or words that would lead a person reading a certain document to think that maybe something happened, really actually happened, not a plan, but an actual action happened somewhere. So often the declassifiers are just working by word lists.
Nicholson Baker is my guest. His new book is a must read. And I've got to tell you, I just thoroughly enjoyed this book, Nicholson. Baseless, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. There's lots of quotes in your book, and there's one that I've picked out here, and as I said to you earlier, I've picked out a lot of things in your book, but here's one. This is Dr. Haskins. Before we go into this, can you talk about Dr. Haskins, because he's an important character?
He was a fascinating figure. I encountered him when I was doing some research into the history of microfilm, but he was a guy who was an expert in ant societies and human societies and the similarities between them both. And he was covered in glory, many awards. He did a lot of consulting for the CIA, and he helped organize the CIA's early mind control effort called Project Artichoke, which was a way of interrogating people, helping to get better answers from people that were being questioned.
So the quote, if you don't mind, I'm just going to read from your book. And the quote from Dr. Haskins is, "When they go to war, they stab each other, spray poison, and cut off each other's heads. They subjugate weak races and keep slaves. But they can be kind, too." That just amazed me that they can be kind, too.
And he's talking not about people. He's talking about ants.
Yes, yes.
Ants can be kind, too.
Yes, 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 yes.
No, he's a fascinating person. And he's actually a good example of this use of at the very highest levels of American science, this use of the most distinguished and, well, the smartest people really in science were used by the CIA and by the Air Force to help perfect things that would, you know, help us win the Cold War with Russia. And so, and what did that do to this country? What was the effect? Is part of what the book is asking is, you know, what kind of distortions to a country's path in life happen when its most brilliant scientists are paid to do things that they would never normally do and that really sound creepy?
Yes. I got the feeling there was a couple of times I read where you're almost like you feel like you're overwhelmed with the information, even mm-hmm. though you haven't getting all the information with what you've got so far, you're mm-hmm. overwhelmed. Can you talk about that, Nicholson?
I think that's one of the things that historians, and believe me, I'm not a historian in the sense that really great historians are, but historians have to contend with the fact that their minds are overflowing and they're alive with a kind of a state of permanent smoldering decay of all the factual knowledge that they have about whatever period they're studying. Because there's too much. There's too much to say about life. Any given day, there's too much. But consider that you're trying to write about the Civil War or about Reconstruction or the Depression or the Dust Bowl, anything, or the Cold War. There are so many thousands of individual people, each one of them potentially interesting. So I reached periodically these moments of being, I don't know, it was a combination of being drowning, but also being exhausted, but also feeling kind of intoxicated by the fact that even so, there were things I didn't know. So this feeling of both wanting to know more and having too much to work with, having too much paper, you know, because in my office, there are boxes and boxes of declassified documents, and you have to keep those in your head. And then you have to remember that some of the documents are not there. And then and you have to remember all the people involved and who they were. It's important to know not just them as a name, but as a person who had a life. So it's really hard to do. And I guess the point of writing it as a diary is to convey to the reader that this project, this enterprise of doing any kind of history of anything is a project that has ups and downs. You have down days. You have days where you're dejected, or you have days where you finally make a breakthrough. For instance, I might be able to decipher someone's name behind a scribbled redaction mark.
Yeah.
You know, a breakthrough like that was kind of a great moment.
Yes.
So I wanted to include all of those, all that flux of reversals and a kind of the slalom course that one negotiates in trying to write about something that happened a long time ago.
There was a point in reading your book when you're talking about North Korea and also when you're talking about Cuba, and vis-a-vis biological weapons and chemical warfare, when I stopped to think to myself, have we been misled for so long about how we consider North Korea and how we consider Cuba? Did you think that?
Well, I don't know if it's yes. I guess the short answer is we haven't thought about it enough. So North Korea does bizarre things.
Yeah.
Cuba did bizarre things. But part of the reason that North Korea is such a puzzling place is because in the Korean War, the American Air Force did everything it could with napalm and other fire weapons to burn the entire country. It was so completely burned, village by village and city by city, that the North Korean people survived by living in caves. Think about that. I mean, that's just a horrifying notion that we were so frightened of this communist movement that was in the north of a country that we had artificially divided. They didn't put that parallel in there. We did that. The Americans drew that line, that we were willing to, you know, hire the Air Force to burn the country down.
Yes.
That's so what is the long shadow, I guess, of that trauma is a question worth asking. And in the case of Cuba, it was simply intolerable to Eisenhower and Kennedy and Kennedy's brother, Bobby Kennedy, that there would be a communist-flavored island that close to the United States. It just simply was so deeply unpleasant that they were willing to talk about all kinds of outlandish ways to make life worse for the Cubans. And the one that has only recently been declassified that I talk about in the book it was only declassified in 2017. After all these years, Kennedy and his team thought seriously about the idea of making the Cuban sugar crop suffer epidemic losses by introducing a sugar cane disease. That particular passage has been blacked out or whited out of all of the documents of Operation Mongoose since Operation Mongoose started in the early 60s.
I'm curious about putting the book together. It took you, what, 10 years to write this book?
In the sense of doing the research. Right. I had to write other books in the meanwhile, but while I was waiting for documents to be produced, I wrote other books. But yeah, it's been a more than 10-year project. It's the hardest thing I ever did.
Here we are in 2020, and such strange things are going on in our world right now with COVID and I don't really want to get into the whole presidential thing, but in a way, there's some things going on right now that are so disturbing, so strange. But I wonder, again, for you, as this book is coming out, as you're getting your galley proofs of this book, you're going, could this book be coming out in a more stranger time?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we are in this really disturbing health emergency. At the same time, we're in a kind of revolution of understanding and thinking about race relations. At the same time, we are watching a president just act in the most unthinkably ridiculous way. And the combination of these things and the unexpectedness of each new development I certainly never have experienced anything like it. And while all this was going on, I was, of course, doing the last minute copy editing, and then I read the audiobook aloud to have an audio version of the book. And so I lived through this book that I'd written before COVID and before the whole kind of huge uprising of the Black Lives Matter movement. I was reading this book that was written in an earlier, more innocent time, maybe, I don't know, and thinking my way through it. And it's so strange to read this account of long ago science and see that it applies right now. I mean, the book is filled with, it's filled with sickness. I mean, it's filled with diseases. It's filled with the scientists hired to make a given disease that might be infected pigs or birds, figure out a way that that disease would infect human beings and then crank up the disease. So this was a technique learned from the Japanese germ scientists, but by working with the disease through many, many experimental animals, you can make a disease more contagious, more virulent.
Yes.
You can make bad things worse. And that's what they were doing all through the 50s and through the 60s until Nixon. It's one of his first decisions, essentially put an end to the program. So now we're in this state of being in the midst of a really unprecedentedly infectious, contagious, virulent disease. And so a lot of these things and the carnage that the earlier diseases were the victims of a germ warfare development program, of a research program. The first victims are the scientists who are trying to engineer the diseases, you know, the lab outbreaks are the first indication that you have a good weaponizable toxic product.
Which leads me to ask you, Nicholson, what you thought of the suggestion that COVID had been manufactured in a lab in China?
It's a very difficult question. I think it's too early to. It's almost too early to ask it. But there is no reason to exclude a laboratory. We know that coronaviruses have been manipulated in a recombinant fashion in laboratories all over the world. And we know that this has been going on for at least 15 years. So if there was a mishap in Wuhan, and there may well have been, and we should obviously, the World Health Organization should be allowed to look at every freezer and look at every notebook. But if there was, it is the result of a more than decade-long collaboration and a funding from American science. So it's not something that should ever be used as some sort of grounds of further antagonism between China and the United States. I mean, this is the saddest thing about all of this is that the Cold War is just rushing back.
Yes.
I mean, the whole anti-Russian sentiment and the fierce demonization of China and the desire just not to get along with former allies is so much like what I kept kind of feeling I was simmering in writing.
Yes.
This. Why is it coming back when it wasn't a good idea the first time? It caused so much harm the first time. You know, let's just try to be good citizens of the world and get along with the other people, acknowledging that our governments have failings. Our government, our current government, has many flaws and failings, regardless of your affiliation as a Democrat or Republican. And all these other countries, all yes. of them have repressive elements and liberal elements and reasonable people who are just trying to, you know, sell eggs at the supermarket, and crazy people at the top who want to make nefarious weapons. This is just human nature. There's a range of people in every country. But turning other countries into dark enemies who have plans for world domination just stimulates the paranoid elements of our own society. And it's bad for us as a people, as yeah. the American people, to have this kind of rhetoric floating around. And I just wish it would stop.
I was wondering, Nicholson, how important it was for you, because you're tackling some very dark topics, to have this almost not whimsical, but this other side of your story, which is you and your dogs and your wife and where you live and talking to the local people on your walks. How important was that for you, for Nicholson Baker, to do that juxtaposition?
I think that was crucially important. And thanks so much for asking about that, because if you make a decision to write about the worst, darkest periods of human history, and I did that about World War II, it takes a toll. It is depressing to write about depressing things, as you can imagine. And I feel that a book needs to be fundamentally, every book, even books about the darkest passages of what we've been through as a species, needs to be fundamentally evidence for the fact that life is worth living, that there's a reason for all this, and that it is fundamentally good to be alive, which is my belief.
Yes.
So if you are studying and kind of laying down all kinds of plans to make foreign civilians ill and foreign pigs and foreign chickens and foreign wheat crops wither, I think you have to have something to put on the other side of the scale. And the other side of the scale, it's not that hard, because life is fantastic. It's beautiful. And all you have to do is go for a walk or look at a river or just, you know, make a peanut butter sandwich.
Yes.
You know, and you will get that feeling of the immediacy and the preciousness and the kind of, I don't know, the sparkle of the present helps just to come. I think as soon as you allow that in, it counterbalances the darkness of the other part of the task that you have at hand. So the idea of writing it as a diary and having, well, we had these dogs. I mean, it was partly just I got lucky. My wife and I went to the Humane Society in Bangor, near where we are, and there were these dogs, and they wanted to be with us, you know,
yes,
and
yes.
They were nice. They were nice, barky dogs, and they were very nervous because they were middle-aged and been rescue dogs. They'd been mistreated. So, of course, one of the dogs immediately peed all over the cement of the place we were meeting. And it was just, you know, there's a lot of worry and nervousness on their part. And they slowly got to like us, and they insisted on sleeping in our bed, which was difficult, and they made lots of noise. So part of it also, as I was dealing with the sleep deprivation of these two new animals in my life. So it just happened that I got really lucky that two bony, intensely loving creatures entered my life at the same time, almost to the day that I started writing a history of horrible things that happened 70 years ago.
It's lovely because you you teach us, or you tell us about the personality of these dogs, and it really comes through. We get to learn about them as the story goes on. One other thing is that, I think I've already mentioned this, but I'd like to point it out again to my listeners, and that is that you talk about where you live. You also talk about going to the post office, and I feel like I know that post office. I mean, it's just like, it's great stuff. It really is. My guest is Nicholson Baker. His book is called Baseless, and the subtitle is very, very important. My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. Nicholson, the story goes on. You give us such a lot of detail, such a lot of information. Was there a point for you as you're writing the book? You've got this other part of your life going on. You're writing other books. You've got these two dogs. You've got a wife. You've got snow falling in Maine. Was there a point when it was you I'm not going to say wanted to give up, but so much as you went, okay, how much more have I got to endure? Am I going to put myself through any more of this?
Well, I think that did happen. It happened in earlier attempts at writing the book. So the book was abandoned several times because I didn't have a way of, I didn't have a form that worked. But even in this current version, there were times in which I thought, I guess I wanted to ask the question is, when is a book done? If you know that you are not going to learn certain crucial pieces of information because the government still feels their deep, dark secrets, when do you stop, you know, with a book? That's a question. And I remember, I actually write about it here. I got up in the morning and think, when does the book, because by then I had a stack of pages. I knew I had something. When do you stop? Because it's, you know, it's the Cold War. It's a gigantic topic. And I thought, when you stop is when, not when you come to the answers, because you're not going to come to all the answers, but when you stop being curious about what actually happened. When your curiosity dies, that's when you've got to go into a different project. Yes. And I still had these nagging moments of curiosity when I was thinking that. It was a good question to ask, because I suddenly thought, well, but I am curious. I still am curious about this whole thing that happened when Czechoslovakia said that the United States had dropped potato beetles. What's that all about? I still was curious about that. I mean, there were things that were unresolved. And so it helped me realize that I was almost at the end, but that I had to just push a little farther and just draw on a few more reserves of whatever it was. The funds of, I don't want to say strength, because, but of something within that would allow me to get to the end and then just have that blissful moment, which I do love that feeling that it is a book. It feels like a book. It feels done, you know, and that's a strange, it's very hard to predict when that will happen, but it has to do with exhaustion and with euphoria and with a certain number of pages. I mean, it's all sorts of, right, you know, timelines and charts are involved.
Well, it wasn't really a rhetorical question so much as I wanted just to use the question as an opportunity just to read this. And you say, and this is at the end of your book, you say, that's enough. I've worn myself out. I need to take a break from thinking about germs and spies and balloons and generals and coups and death by starvation. Life is green and grassy. Then you say, walk the dogs with dear M. The dandelions are coming up everywhere. Little spiky explosions in the grass. A dollop of yellow pigment seen through tears. Love that. Oh, it's so provocative and so wonderful. I love it. Then, if you don't mind me saying this, at the very end, in your epilogue at the end, you say, Russians were deceived. The biological arms race intensified. Germy stews were cooked up in unsafe laboratories around the world. Oh my. And it sort of leaves it, make me thinking, oh my, is Nicholson preparing us for another 10 years of research?
I hope not. No, I can't do this again. I can never do this again. This is the best I can do with this messy reality. But I'm so glad that you took the ending the way I meant it to be taken. It's, there is a moment when you have to stop. You have to stop thinking about things that are wrong or bad or mistaken. You have to submit to the argument that the world is giving one right now, which is that there are dandelions. The dandelions,
yes.
I love dandelions. I live for dandelions. And finally, the snows had melted and the rains had come and kind of washed off all the road salt. And these, you know, dutiful, well-meaning little plants were coming up. And since the whole book was about anti-crop warfare, kept coming up in the book of ways to kill plants, make them wilt and turn brown and not grow their little grains of food.
Yes.
The idea that the dandelions were just going to spontaneously come up and go beautifully yellow. I was so grateful to them. So, yeah, thank you.
You know, you, Nicholson, you have a wonderful way of just touching on some very, I'm not going to say mundane, but everyday things like dandelions growing. This is what I love about your writing, which now leads me to ask you about writing this book as opposed to writing fiction, because this book at times does feel like fiction. Yet you're giving us stories about your life, everyday life, and you're also talking about chemical warfare, biological warfare. So for you, for Nicholson Baker, sitting down to write this book, is your process different from writing fiction?
Well, it's a little bit different because at every given moment, it has to be as true as I can make it. So that means if I'm writing about something that happened in Guatemala in 1954, I have to be telling the truth. I have to figure out what happened, and then I have to explain what happened, and then I have to be sure that I have end notes that can lead the reader who is doubtful that my account is correct to determine from my sources that I knew what I was talking about. So there's an awful lot of machinery kind of clanking and cranking underneath that isn't necessarily there when I am writing a book about a guy who's very like me, who is trying to his best to be a poet, or even when I was working on the book about being a substitute teacher.
Yeah.
I'm just writing about what happened that day, and that, yes. So I am the source. So, so there are differences, but actually, you know, word by word and sentence by sentence, it still comes down to the same thing, which is just that every sentence is like it's like a little root nodule that has a growth tip, and there's always this sort of pushing forward feeling of feeling your way in through the soil, looking for the nutrients, trying to see, well, should I turn left here? You know, is there going to be more water over here? The feeling of writing is almost always fundamentally the same, which is just the quest for the next droplet of moisture or of nutrients in the narrative that is unfolding.
You know, I had a thought that if it was possible, you would have asked the two dogs to do a little overview of your book. I just think that you trust those dogs so much and you like them so much that you would like to get their opinion.
Well, they knew that I was sitting at the kitchen table at a very early hour because I often got up before they got up. And so they knew that I was working because they could see the glow of my screen.
Yeah.
And they knew when I made coffee. And they knew when I reached the moment when I had run out of things to say that morning. And that was time for breakfast. So yeah. I think they knew how to read my personal habits. And then I would bring coffee into my wife, who's called M in this, but she's really,
yes,
Margaret. And so, yeah, I think they knew that they knew they were rooting for me to make some progress, but not too much progress because they wanted breakfast.
Yeah, exactly. Nicholson, last question for you. It's been just wonderful talking to you again.
And to you.
Was there a point in putting the book together and writing the book, or maybe when you finished it, did you have any anger? Were you annoyed?
Well, there are a couple moments that I decided to allow a little anger in the book. I mean, anger is a very tricky substance to use. But there was a moment when the Mueller report was released, because obviously I'm not writing this in a vacuum. The Mueller report was released, and I'd been writing on and on about redactions and the toll that it takes on the spirits of the historian. And suddenly there's this document that everybody's been just sort of breathlessly waiting for, and it comes out and it has these huge, just awful.
Yes.
So I said, I allowed myself to get angry with that. I used a lot of exclamation points. I said, I'm so damn sick of redactions at this point. The garbage bag of truth stretched across the thing. And the phrase that really ticked me off was this phrase, harm to ongoing matter. On the Mueller report, every single one of these blackouts, most of them, they had the reason given was HOM, harm to ongoing matter. And you think, what is the harm here? Is the harm to ongoing matter? Is the harm to ongoing knowledge that the people would actually be able to know what our own government wrote in this terribly important document? Isn't the harm being done to us?
Yes.
Ongoing matter. So I did allow, there are a few little outbursts of petulance or anger or impatience. I mean, impatience. But really, in order to do this kind of history, you have to work on, it's good for the character, you have to work on patience. You have to be patient. And so I tried to let that emotion surface more often.
Thank you for writing this book.
Thank you for asking me such beautiful questions about it and talking about it. I was really happy to think about it again with you, Armin.
You're a wonderful guest. I love talking with you. The book is called Baseless, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of Freedom of Information Acts. Nicholson Baker has been my guest. Nicholson, I'm holding the book up so everybody can see once again. It really is a fabulous read. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Norman.
Thank you so much to my guests, and a very large thank you to you for listening. Now, your feedback is always welcome. Let me know what you think about Life Elsewhere. My email address will come up in the closing credits. Until next time, please be safe, be good, and always, it costs nothing. Be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.